know their real names? You don't think that at some point the butterfly names became real? They're legal names, then. Some of them.
We could have been notifying their families by now, says Edison. Why didn't you tell us this earlier?
Because I don't like you, she says bluntly, and he yanks the photos out from under her hands. The girl cocks an eyebrow. You really believe knowledge brings closure, don't you? She asks. She might be incredulous or mocking, Victor isn't sure. Maybe it's something else entirely.
The families deserve to know what happened.
Do they?
Yes!
Shoving back from the table, Edison starts pacing before the one-way mirror.
Some of them have been waiting for decades to get word of their loved ones. If they can just know that they can finally give up.
Her eyes track him back and forth across the small room. So, you never heard?
What?
Whoever went missing, you never heard. Victor curses under his breath at his partner's stricken face.
Oh, the girl is good. He can admit that. Not that it's hard to irritate Edison, but to really get under his skin? Go see about getting some food delivered, he orders. Take a few minutes.
The door slams behind Edison. Who was it? Asks Inara.
Do you really think it's any of your business?
How much of what you've asked me is really any of yours?
It's not the same, and they both know it.
I don't believe the knowledge helps, Inara says after a moment. If my parents are alive, if they're dead, it doesn't change what happened way back then. It stopped hurting a long time ago, as soon as I accepted that they weren't coming back.
Your parents chose to leave, he reminds her. None of you chose to be kidnapped.
She looks down at her burned hands. I guess I don't see the difference. If one of Sophia's girls was kidnapped, do you think she'd ever rest until she knew?
Inara blinks.
But how does it help? To know they've been dead for years? To know they were raped and murdered and then violated further in death?
Because then they no longer have to wonder. Don't you think the girls in the apartment worried about you?
People leave, she says with a shrug. But you would have gone back if you could, he hazards. She doesn't answer. Has it ever occurred to her to go back, that she could?
He sighs and rubs tiredly at his face. This isn't a debate either of them can win.
The door smacks against the wall as it opens too quickly, and Edison stalks back in. Victor swears under his breath and starts to rise, but Edison shakes his head.
Let me go, Vic. I know the line.
Crossing that line in college got the FBI interested in hiring him. Crossing it a few times since has gotten him in trouble. Beneath the remnants of red-faced fury, though, Victor can see calm determination. It's enough for Victor to sit back down, just in case he stays on the edge of his seat. Edison walks around the table so he can lean over Inara.
As you like to say, here's the thing. Most people are missed. I'm sorry that you had such a shitty family. I am. No child deserves to grow up that way. I'm sorry no one missed you. But you don't get to decide for all those other girls that no one's missing them.
He sets a picture frame on the table. Victor doesn't have to look to know what the frame holds.
This is my sister, Faith, says Edison. She disappeared when she was 8, and no, we never heard. We don't know if she's alive or dead. 20 years my family has searched and waited for word. Even if we had found her body, at least we'd finally know. I'd stopped looking at blondes in their late 20s and wondering if one of them is Faith, if I'm walking right by her and don't know it. My mother could stop updating the website she hopes Faith will stumble across. My father could take the reward for information money he's been saving all these years and fix the house that's falling down around them. We could finally put my sister to rest and let her go. Not knowing is crippling. It will take a long time to get those girls out of the resin, even longer to make positive IDs. Too long. You have the chance to give these families peace. You have the chance to let them finally grieve and move on with their lives. You have the chance to give these girls back to their families. The little girl in the picture is wearing a pink glitter tiara and a Ninja Turtle costume, complete with eye mask and pink tutu, and holding a Wonder Woman pillowcase in one hand. A much younger Edison holds her other hand, smiling down at her. He's not in a costume, but the girl grinning back at him with two bottom teeth missing doesn't seem to care. Inara touches the child's glass-covered smile. She touched Lionette's photo that way.
"He took pictures of us," she says eventually. "Front and back, once the tattoos were done. If he took them, he must have kept them. Not in his garden suite, I looked once, but Lionette thought he probably put them into some kind of book to keep him company when he had to be away from the garden."
She studies the photo another moment, then hands the frame back to him.
"Lottie was nearly 8.
"I'll call CSU," Edison tells Victor. "Have them check the house again." He carefully tucks the frame under one arm and leaves the room. The silence that follows is broken by Inara's soft snort.
"I still don't like him."
"You're allowed," Victor says with a laugh. "Did Desmond ever see this book?" She shrugs.
"If he did, he never mentioned it.
But at some point, he discovered the true nature of the garden. At some point."
The first time Desmond used his new codes was after midnight on a Thursday. Well, technically Friday. It was a week or so after his father finally programmed him into the security system. A week of visiting only with his father, of not asking questions even when his father had walked away. 3 weeks now he'd known of the garden, but not the real one. I'd spent most of the day secluded in Simone's room, helping her with cold cloths and glasses of water as she suffered through constant nausea and vomiting. It was the third day in a row, and we'd thus far managed to keep it from Lorraine, but I wasn't sure how long that could last. Between the nausea and some specific points of tenderness, I had the bad feeling Simone was pregnant. It happened sometimes because no contraception is completely foolproof, but it always meant another filled display case and a temporarily empty room. I don't think Simone had realized her condition yet. She thought Avery had brought the flu back into the garden. She was finally asleep, one hand pressed against her stomach, and Danelle had promised to stay with her until the morning. The smell of sour, stale vomit clung to me, strong enough to make me semi-nauseated as well. I'd long since earned the privilege of turning my shower on whenever I wanted, but the idea of being stuck in another little room was almost physically painful. I stopped by the room just long enough to shove my dress and underwear down the laundry chute, far too narrow for a person to fit through, as Bliss had informed me, and went out into the garden itself. At night, the garden was a place of shadows and moonlight, where you could more clearly hear all the illusions that went into making it what it was. During the day there was conversation and movement, sometimes games or songs, and it masked the sound of the pipes feeding water and nutrients through the beds, of the fans that circulated the air. At night, the creature that was the garden peeled back its synthetic skin to show the skeleton beneath. I liked the garden at night for the same reason I loved the original fairy tales. It was what it was, nothing more and nothing less. Unless the gardener was visiting you, darkness in the garden was the closest we got to truth. I stepped through the echoing cave and into the falls, letting the water pour over me and wash away the sourness of sickness and coming death. It was just strong enough to beat at muscles sore and tired from 3 days of bending over someone, of perching on an uncomfortable stool and expecting every second for Lorraine or the gardener to come investigate. I let the water pound that away, then used the mist-dampened rocks to haul myself up to the top of the cliff and the sun rock. I wrung most of the water from my hair and then lay back with closed eyes, sprawled inelegantly over the rock, with its trace of sun warmth left over from the day. Breath by breath, I could feel my muscles slowly relax. Direct, but not very modest. I sat up so fast, something seized in my back, and I spent the next several minutes swearing at people who couldn't give proper warning. Desmond stood on the path, 5 or 10 yards away, hands shoved deep in his pockets, craning his neck back to stare at the glass tiles of the greenhouse roof. "Good evening," I said sourly, rearranging myself more comfortably on the rock. All of my clothing was either in my room or waiting to be laundered, so there wasn't much point in shrieking and trying to find something to cover myself with. "Come to take in the view?" Rather more of a view than I expected. I thought I was alone. "Alone?" he repeated, meeting my eyes and very carefully not looking any lower. "In an entire garden full of other girls?" "Who are all either sleeping or occupying themselves in their rooms," I retorted. "Ah." That was the last thing said for some time. It sure as hell wasn't my job to supply conversation, so I turned on the stone and looked out into the garden, watching the surface of the pond ripple and sway where water emptied from the stream. Eventually, I heard his footsteps on the stone, and then something dark hovered in front of me. When I reached out to touch it, it dropped into my lap. His sweater. The color was hard to determine in the moonlight, maybe a burgundy of some sort, with a school crest sewn onto one breast. It smelled like soap and aftershave and cedar, something warm and masculine and mostly unfamiliar in the garden. I twisted my wet hair into a messy knot atop my head and pulled on the sweater, and when everything was covered, he sat next to me on the rock. "I couldn't sleep," he said quietly. "So you came out here?" "I just can't make sense of this place."
"Given that it doesn't make sense, that's understandable."
"So you're not here by choice."
I sighed and rolled my eyes. "Stop looking for information you have no intention of actually using."
"How do you know I won't use it?"
"Because you want him to be proud of you," I said sharply. "And you know if you tell anyone about all this, he won't be. Given that, what does it matter whether we're here by choice or not?"
You must think I'm a despicable excuse for a human being."
"I think you have the potential to be." I looked at his sad, earnest face and decided to take a risk for pretty much the first time since coming to the garden. "I also think you have the potential to be better." He was silent for a long time. Such a tiny step, a minuscule nudge, but already it seemed too big. How could a parent have so much control over a child? That paternal pride meant more than what was right.
"Our choices make us who we are," he said eventually.
It wasn't what I'd call a substantive response. "What choices are you making, Desmond?"
"I don't think I'm making any choices right now."
"Then you're automatically making the wrong ones." He straightened, mouth open to protest, but I held up my hand. "Not making a choice is a choice. Neutrality is a concept, not a fact. No one actually gets to live their lives that way."
"Seemed to work for Switzerland."
"As a nation, maybe. How do you think individuals felt when they learned the truth of what their neutrality allowed to transpire? When they learned of the camps and the gas chambers and the experimentation, do you think they were pleased with their neutrality then?"
"Then why don't you just leave?"
he demanded.
"Rather than judge my father for giving you food and clothing and comfortable shelter, why don't you just go back out there?"
"You don't really think we have codes, do you?" He deflated, the indignation fading as quickly as it flared.
"He keeps you locked in?"
"Collectors don't let butterflies fly free. It defeats the purpose."
"You could ask."
It isn't easy to ask him for anything, I said, parroting his words from a week or so ago. He flinched. He was blind, but he wasn't stupid. That he chose to be ignorant really pissed me off. I shrugged out of the sweater and dropped it in his lap, sliding off the rock. Thank you for the conversation, I muttered, walking quickly down the path that sloped to the main level from the far end of the cliff. I could hear him tripping and fumbling after me. Maya, wait. His hand closed around my wrist and tugged back, nearly pulling me off my feet. I'm sorry. You're between me and food. Apologize for that, if you like, and get out of my way. He let go of my wrist, but kept following me across the garden. He hopped first across the small stream and reached out to steady me from the other side, something I found both bizarre and charming. The main lights in the dining room and the attached open kitchen were dark, but a dim light shone from above the stove for anyone seeking a late-night snack. The sight of the larger, locked fridge momentarily distracted him. I yanked open the door to the smaller one and studied what was inside. I was genuinely hungry, but as being around vomiting people doesn't do much for the appetite, nothing seemed appealing. What is that on your back? I slammed the door shut, blocking out the light, but it was too late. He stepped closer behind me, walking us both over to the oven, and in the dim glow of the stove light, he studied the wings in all their exquisite, excruciating detail. Under normal circumstances, I could have mostly forgotten what they looked like. He'd give us mirrors if we asked for them. I never had. Bliss, though, made a point of showing everyone their wings on a regular basis, so we couldn't forget what we were. Butterflies are short-lived creatures, and that, too, was part of her reminder. His fingertips brushed against the darker veins of brown, against the fawn-colored upper wings, stretching as the lines splayed outward into the delicate chevrons. I stood perfectly still despite the goosebumps that crawled down my spine at his tentative exploration. He hadn't asked, but then he was his father's son, I supposed. My eyes closed, my hands curling into fists at my sides, as his fingers moved lower into the bottom wings of roses and purples. He didn't follow the lines down, but in, toward my spine, until he could run a thumb up the entire length of black ink that ran down the center of my back. That's gorgeous, he whispered. Why a butterfly? Ask your father. Suddenly his hand was trembling against my skin, against the mark of his father's ownership. He didn't move it away, though. He did this to you? I didn't answer. How badly did it hurt? What hurt most was lying there, letting him do it. But I didn't say that. I didn't say that it hurt so fucking badly to see those first lines appear on each new girl's back. Didn't say that the skin had been so raw I hadn't slept on my back for weeks. Didn't say that I still couldn't sleep on my stomach because it made me remember that first rape on the tattoo bench, when he drove himself into me and gave me a new name. I didn't say anything. Does he do this to all of you? He asked shakily. I nodded. Oh, God! Run, I screamed silently. Run and tell the police, or open the doors and let us tell the police ourselves. Just do something, anything, other than stand there. But he didn't. He stayed behind me, his hand against the map of ink and scars, until the silence became a living, gasping thing between us. So I was the one to move away, to open the fridge again and pretend there was anything normal about this moment. I pulled out an orange, swung the door closed with my hip, and leaned against the part of the counter that ran perpendicular to the rest. It wasn't quite an island, but it created a waist-high separation between the kitchen and the dining room. Desmond tried to join me there, but his legs gave out, and he slid to the floor next to my feet, his back against the cabinets. His shoulder brushed against my knee as I methodically peeled the orange. I always tried to get it off in one piece, a perfect spiral. So far, I never had. It always broke partway through. Why does he do it? Why do you think? Shit! He brought his knees up and hunched over them, his arms crossed against the back of his head. I freed the first wedge and sucked it dry, setting the seeds on the peel as I found them. And the silence grew. When all the juice was gone from the wedge, I popped the whole thing in my mouth and chewed. Hope used to tease me about how I ate oranges, saying I made boys very uncomfortable. I'd stuck out my tongue at her and told her boys didn't have to watch. Desmond certainly wasn't watching anyway. I moved on to the second wedge, then the third, and the fourth.
"Still awake, Maya?"
came the gardener's light voice from the doorway.
"Are you feeling well?"
Desmond looked up, his face pale and stricken, but he didn't stand or say anything to announce his presence. Sitting on the floor against the cabinets, he wouldn't be seen unless the gardener came all the way to the counter and looked straight down. The gardener never came into the kitchen itself. "I'm feeling fine," I answered. "I just decided to get a snack after rinsing off in the falls."
"And didn't want to be bothered with clothing."
He laughed and entered the dining room, sitting down in the large padded chair that was reserved for him. So far as I knew, he'd never seen the rough crown Bliss had scratched into the back. It was vaguely throne-like, I'd given her that, with a deep cushion of dark red velvet and nearly black polished wood rising into ornate scrolls above his head. He pushed it back, one elbow resting on the edge of the table because the chair had no arms. I shrugged, picking another wedge from the orange. It seemed a little silly to worry. He looked strangely casual, sitting in the shadows wearing nothing but a pair of silky pajama pants. His plain gold wedding band gleamed with fractures of light from the stove. I couldn't tell if he'd been sleeping in his suite, or if he'd been with one of the other girls, though he didn't generally sleep in our rooms. Unless his wife was out of town, he usually spent at least part of each night in the house I'd never seen. Couldn't see, even from the tallest tree in the garden.
"Come sit with me."
At my feet, Desmond pressed his fist against his mouth with a pained look. Leaving the rest of the orange on the counter with the peel and seeds, I obediently came around the counter and crossed into the shadows to join him at his table. I started to lower myself onto the nearest bench, but he pulled me into his lap. One hand stroked along my back and hip, something he did without thinking, while the other clasped one of my hands against my thigh.
"How are the girls reacting to Desmond being here?"
If he'd had any idea how here Desmond was, I doubted we'd be having this conversation. "They're wary," I answered finally. "I think we're all waiting to see if he's more like you or Avery."
"And hoping for?"
I slanted him a sideways look, and he actually laughed, pressing a kiss against my collarbone.
"They're not afraid of him, surely. Desmond would never hurt anyone."
"I'm sure they'll all adjust to his being here."
"And you, Maya? What do you think of my younger son?"
I almost looked toward the kitchen, but if he didn't want his father to know he was there, I wouldn't give him away. "I think he's confused. He doesn't really know what to make of all this." I took a deep breath, gave myself a moment to convince myself that the next question was for Desmond's sake, to give him another view into the reality of the garden. "Why the displays?"
"What do you mean?"
"After keeping us, why do you keep us?" He didn't answer for a time, his fingers tracing nonsense symbols on my skin.
"My father collected butterflies,"
he said eventually.
"He went hunting for them, and if he couldn't capture them in good condition, he paid others for them, and he pinned them into their display cases while they were still alive. Every one of them had a black velvet background, a little bronze plaque giving its common and proper names, creating a veritable museum of shadow boxes on his office walls. Sometimes he'd hang my mother's embroidery between the cases. Sometimes there were single butterflies, sometimes entire bouquets, picked out in beautiful colors on the cloth."
His hand left my thigh and traveled up my back, tracing the wings. He didn't even have to look at them to know their shapes.
"He was happiest in that room, and once he retired, he spent almost every day in there. but there was a small electrical fire in that section of the house, and all the butterflies were ruined. Every single one. The collection he'd spent decades acquiring and working on. He was never quite the same after that, and died not long after. I suppose he felt as though his entire life had been burned away in that fire. The day after his funeral, Mother and I had to attend an Independence Day fair in town. They were presenting Mother with an award for her charity work, and she didn't want to disappoint anyone by not attending. I left her in the company of sympathetic friends and wandered through the small fair. And then I saw her. A girl, wearing a butterfly mask made of feathers, and passing out little feather and silk rose petal butterflies to the children who came through the silk maze. She was so vibrant and bright, so very alive, it was hard to believe that butterflies could ever die. When I smiled at her and went into the maze, she followed me in. It wasn't hard to get her home from there. I kept her in the basement at first, until I could build the garden to be a proper home. I was in school, and I'd just taken over my father's business, and before too long I was married, so I think she was very lonely, even once I moved her into the garden. So I brought in Lorraine for her and others to be her friends.
He was lost in memory, but for him it wasn't painful. For him it only made sense, was only right. Rather than bringing his Eve to a garden, he'd built one around her, and served as the angel with the flaming sword to keep her in. He rearranged me on his lap, tugging me against his chest until he could lay my head between his neck and shoulder.
Her death was heartbreaking, and I couldn't bear to think that brief existence was all she would ever have. I didn't want to forget her. As long as I could remember her, a part of her would still live. I built the cases, researched ways to preserve her against decay.
"The resin," I whispered. And he nodded.
But first, the embalming. My company keeps formaldehyde and formaldehyde resins on hand in the manufacturing division. For clothing, if you can believe it. It's easy to order more than they need and bring the rest here. Replacing the blood with the formaldehyde retards decay. Enough for the resin to preserve everything else. Even when you're gone, Maya, you will not be forgotten.
The sick thing was, he genuinely meant it to be comforting. Unless an accident happened or I pissed him off, in 3.5 years he would run formaldehyde through my veins. I knew just enough to know that he would stay with me the entire time, maybe even brushing my hair and pinning it into its final arrangement. And when all my blood was gone, he'd place me in a glass case and pump it full of clear resin to give me a second life no mere electrical fire could end. He would touch the glass and whisper my name every time he passed, and he would remember me. And sitting in his lap left no illusions as to how he felt about all of that. He gently pushed me off his lap, spreading his legs to make me kneel between them, one hand tangling in my hair.
"Show me that you won't forget me, Maya."
He pulled my head closer, his other hand busy at the drawstring of his pants.
"Not even then?"
Not even when I was long dead and gone, and the sight of me would still be enough to make him hard. And I obeyed, because I always obeyed, because I still wanted those 3.5 years, even if it meant this man telling me he loved me. I obeyed when he damn near choked me, and I obeyed when he yanked me back onto his lap, obeyed when he told me to promise I wouldn't ever forget him. And this time, instead of writing someone else's poems and stories against the inside of my skull, I wondered about the boy on the other side of the kitchen counter, listening to it all. The thing that convinced me my long-ago next-door neighbor was a pedophile was more than the looks he gave me. It was the looks the foster children gave each other, the bruised, sick knowledge they shared between them. All of them knew what was happening, not just to themselves, but to each other. None of them would say a word. I saw those bruised looks, and I knew it would only be a matter of time before he put his hand up my dress, before he took my hand and put it in his lap and whispered about a present for me. The gardener kissed me when he was done and told me to make sure I got some rest. He was still pulling his pants back into place as he walked out of the dining room. I walked back to the other side of the counter, picked up the rest of my orange, and sat down next to Desmond, whose face was wet and shiny with tears. He stared at me with dull eyes. Bruised eyes. I ate the rest of the orange in the time it took him to find something to say, and then he didn't say anything at all, just handed me his sweater. I put it on, and when he reached for my hand, I let him take it. He was never going to go to the police. We both knew it. All that the past half hour had changed was that now he hated himself a little for it.
You haven't asked who survived.
You're not going to let me go see them until after I've told you everything you want to know.
True. So I'll find out when we're done, when I can actually spend time with them. My being there now can't change anything anyway. Suddenly, I believe you haven't cried since you were 6. A faint smile flickers across her face.
Fucking carousel.
She agrees pleasantly.
Bliss made a carousel. Did I mention that? She could make damn near anything out of polymer clay, baking sheet after sheet in the oven, with Lorraine scowling at her the entire time as supervision. She was the only one of us with oven privileges. She was also the only one who'd ever asked. The night before she died, in those long hours we spent curled together on her bed, Lionette told us stories about when she was younger. She didn't give us names or locations, but she told them just the same. And the one that made her smile, the one that she loved more than any of the others, was about a carousel. Her father made the figures for a lot of carousels, and sometimes little Cassidy Lawrence would draw some out, and her father would incorporate the designs into the next project, let her choose the colors or the expression on a face. Once her father let her go with him to deliver the horses and sleighs to a traveling carnival. They placed the figures all around the disc, and she sat on the rail and watched as they ran the wiring through the golden poles so the horses moved up and down, and when everything was done, she ran around and around the carousel, petting the horses and whispering their names in their ears so they wouldn't forget. She knew every single one. He didn't mention. The gardener's traits don't exist in isolation, just in extremes. But the horses weren't hers, and when it came time to go home, she had to leave them all behind, probably to never see them again. She couldn't cry because she'd promised her father she wouldn't, promised she wouldn't make a scene when they had to go. That was when she made her first origami horse. In the cab of the truck on the way home, she made her first 2 dozen origami horses, using notebook paper and fast food receipts to practice, until she could make them well, and when she got home, she graduated to using computer paper. She made horse after horse after horse, and colored them all to match the ones she'd left behind, whispering their names as she did. And when she was done, she carefully painted thin dowels and stuck them through the middles with a little bit of glue. She drew out and colored the patterns on the floor, all the paintings on the sloped ceiling, even the pictures framed in the elaborate curlicues that ran along the base of the tent top. And her mother helped her put them all together. Her father even helped her make a crank for the base so the whole thing could slowly spin. Her parents were so proud of her. The morning of the day she was kidnapped, when she left the house for school, the carousel was still sitting in pride of place on the mantel. After Lionette died, I had the nameless new girl to keep me occupied. Bliss had her polymer clay. She didn't show anyone what she was working on, and none of us asked, letting her work through her grief in her own way. She was unusually focused on this project. Honestly, as long as it wasn't a lustrous copper figurine, I wasn't too worried. She'd done that for a few of the other dead girls, and somehow I found those 2-inch-tall butterflies more macabre and disturbing than the girls in the glass. But then the new girl's infection reached a critical point. Her tattoo was never going to heal properly. Even if the infection didn't kill her, the wings would be hopelessly flawed, and that was something the gardener couldn't accept. Not when beauty was why he chose us. The doors had come down in the dark hours of earliest morning, like they would have for her normal tattoo session, but when they came up, she wasn't in the tattoo room or her bed. She never appeared in the display cases. There was no goodbye. There was just nothing.
There was literally nothing left of her, not even a name. Liss was in my room when I came back from looking, sitting cross-legged on my bed with a wrap skirt draped over a bundle in her lap. Dark shadows bruised the pale skin under her eyes, and I wondered how much she'd slept since Lionette had said goodbye to us. I sank down next to her on the bed, one leg curled under my body, and leaned my back against the wall. "Is she dead?" "If not, she soon will be," I sighed. "And then you'll sit through another new girl's arrival in tattoos." "Probably." "Why?" I'd wondered that myself over the past week or so. "Because Lionette thought it was important." She pulled the fabric away from her lap, and there was the carousel. Lionette had made another origami carousel when she came to the garden. It had been sitting on the shelf above Bliss's bed since her death. She'd reproduced all the patterns and designs and colors, and so had Bliss in her own medium. The golden poles even had the spiral ridges. I reached out and nudged the red pennant on top, and the whole thing spun just a little. "I had to make it," she whispered. "But I can't keep it." Bliss broke into furious, heartbroken sobs on my bed. She didn't know about my carousel. She didn't know that I'd sat on a black and red painted horse and finally understood that my parents didn't love me. Or at least didn't love me nearly enough. The day I finally understood and accepted that I wasn't wanted. I lifted it gently out of her lap and nudged her knee with my toe. "Shower." She hiccuped and slid off the bed to obey, and while she washed away 2 weeks of grief and rage, I studied the horses to see if any of them matched the one that I'd splashed with the last of my tears 10 years before. And the answer was, almost. This horse had silver chasings instead of gold, and it had red ribbons tied into its black mane, but otherwise they were very, very close. I shifted onto my knees and placed it on the shelf next to Simba, next to the origami menagerie and the other polymer figures, next to the rocks Evita had painted and the poem Danelle had written and all the other things I'd somehow managed to accumulate after 6 months in the garden. I wondered if I could have Bliss make a tiny girl with dark hair and golden skin to sit on that black and red horse and spin and spin and spin on the carousel and watch all the rest of the world walk away from her. But if I'd asked, she would have asked why, and that little girl didn't need the sympathy so much as she needed to just finally be forgotten. Bliss came out of the shower, body and hair wrapped in violet and rose towels, and finally slept curled against me like one of Sophia's girls. I kept one arm behind my head and I stayed against the wall, and every now and then I reached out and gave the carousel a little nudge so I could watch the black and red horse glide just a little farther away.
He wishes he could let her have that distraction, let the conversation derail, let her avoid the train wreck he has to put her through. But Victor sits forward in his chair and clears his throat, and when she turns her miserable eyes on him, he nods slowly. She sighs and folds her hands in her lap.
For the next week, Desmond stayed out of the garden completely. He didn't use his codes, didn't come in with his father, he just stayed away. Bliss was the one to ask the gardener about it, in her usual appallingly blunt fashion, but he laughed and said not to worry. His son was just focusing on his upcoming finals. I was okay with that. Whether he was hiding, staying away, or just thinking through things, I didn't mind the absence of another male to entertain. I appreciated the space to think. Avery was back in the garden, after all, which meant a constant, subtle interference had to be played to protect the more fragile girls from his interest. Running it all from Simone's bedside just made it more difficult. She'd noticeably lost weight in the past week and a half, unable to keep anything down longer than a half hour or so. During the days, I stayed with her, and during the nights, when Danelle came to relieve me, I went into the garden and slept out on the sun rock, where I could pretend the walls weren't closing in and time wasn't running out. I liked Simone. She was funny and wry, never buying into the bullshit, but making the best of it anyway. I helped her back into bed from another toilet dive, and she clutched my hand. "I'm going to have to take a test, aren't I?"
Bliss said Lorraine had stayed at breakfast asking questions.
Yes, I answered slowly. I think you will.
It'll come up positive, won't it?
I think so. She closed her eyes, one hand pulling away the sweat-damp hair from her forehead.
I should have realized sooner. I saw both my mom and my oldest sister go through pregnancies, and they were sick for 2 months solid.
Want me to pee on the stick for you?
What the hell is wrong with us that is a declaration of love and friendship?
But she shook her head slowly.
I don't want us both dead, which we both know would be the result.
We sat in silence for a while, because some things just don't have an answer.
Can you do me a favor? She asked eventually.
What do you need?
If we have the book in the library, can you read it to me?
When she told me what she wanted, I almost laughed. Almost. Not because it was funny, but because I was relieved that this was one thing I could do for her. I retrieved it from the library, settled next to her on the bed with her hand in mine, and opened the book to the proper page so I could start to read. Most terribly cold it was. It snowed, and was nearly quite dark, and evening, the last evening of the year. In this cold and darkness there went along the street a poor little girl, bareheaded and with naked feet.
What book is that?
Part of a book, the girl corrects. It's The Little Match Girl by Hans Christian Andersen.
Victor can almost remember it, something from a ballet his daughter Brittany did when she was much younger. But it's lost to memories of The Nutcracker and The Steadfast Tin Soldier.
It's the kind of story that makes more sense in the garden than in the real world.
I went on to other stories when that one was done, but fell silent when Lorraine walked in. She had a tray with two lunches on it, and sitting between them was a pregnancy test kit.
I have to be here when you take it, she said.
No shit. Sighing, Simone sat up against the headboard and reached for her glass of water, downing it all in one go. I handed her another glass off the tray, this one of fruit juice, and she drank it down as well. She made a good attempt at lunch, which was just soup and toast, but most of it went untouched. When the water finally got through her system, she grabbed the kit off the tray, stalked to her little toilet, and tugged the curtain to conceal herself. Lorraine hovered in the doorway like a vulture, her shoulders hunched and her eyes on the fabric screen. Simone leaned forward to catch my eye, then jerked her head toward the bitch in the doorway. Nodding, I took a deep breath and started reading The Steadfast Tin Soldier. At the top of my lungs. It earned me a ferocious scowl from the cook nurse, but at least it let Simone piss in peace. We heard the flush, and a moment later she came out from behind the curtain and tossed the dripping stick of plastic at the older woman.
Have fun. Go report. Just get out. Don't you want to?
No, get out! Simone threw herself onto the bed, draping her upper half over my lap.
Will you keep reading?
I laid the book across her back, hiding the dull brown wings of a Mitchell's satyr, and picked back up where we'd left off. She slept through much of the afternoon, waking up from time to time to hurl herself toward the toilet. Danelle joined us for a bit later on, brushing Simone's dark brown hair into an elegant twist. Bliss brought us dinner and pinned small polymer larkspur blooms into the twist. And when I'd eaten and Simone had pushed her food around the plate, Bliss took the trays back to the kitchen for Lorraine. As the deepening evening made the shadows shift in the hallway, the gardener appeared in the doorway. With a dress. It was a multi-layered confection of sheer silks in shades of brown and creams, all meant to echo her wings and flatter her dusky skin tone. Simone looked up at our sudden silence, saw the dress, and quickly turned her face away before he could see her tears.
Ladies?
Blinking rapidly, Danelle kissed the curve of Simone's ear, the closest to her face she could reach, and silently left the room. Simone slowly pushed herself up to sitting and wrapped her arms around me, burying her nose in my shoulder. I squeezed back as tightly as I could, feeling the tremors start.
My name is Rachel. she whispered against my skin. Rachel Young. Will you remember?
I will.
I kissed her cheek and reluctantly let her go. With the book of fairy tales in hand, I walked to the doorway where the gardener lightly kissed me.
She won't be in pain,
he murmured. She'll be dead. This was the part where I was supposed to go back to my room or Bliss's room or Danelle's room. This was the part where we were supposed to gather in small groups, pretending we're anything other than what we are, and mourn the loss that hadn't actually happened yet. This was where we were supposed to wait for Simone to die. And for the first time, I couldn't do it. I just couldn't do it. The lights flickered, our warning to get to our rooms before the walls came down over the doorways. I stepped out onto the sand path, aware of movement in the shadows in the far side of the garden. I wasn't sure if it was Avery, Desmond, or another of the girls, and at the moment, I didn't care. The lights went out, and the walls hissed behind me, settling into their grooves with heavy thumps that fell flat against the silence. Walking deeper into the garden, I stepped along the bank of the stream until I reached the waterfall. I dropped the book on a rock a safe distance from the water and spray, and crossed my arms across my stomach, clutching my elbows against a solid weight growing in my chest. My head lolled back on my neck, and, leaning against the cliff, I stared up at the panes of glass overhead. Stars were winking into sight against the deepening night, some bright and silver, some pale and blue or yellow, and one lone red light that must have been a plane. A tiny flash of light streaked across the sky, and even though I knew the science, knew that it was just space debris, just rock or metal or scrap from a satellite burning up in the atmosphere, all I could think of was that stupid story. "Someone is just dead," said the little girl, for her old grandmother, the only person who had loved her and who was now no more, had told her that when a star falls, a soul ascends to God. And that stupid little girl stood in the winter and kept lighting matches to catch glimpses of families that weren't, could never be, hers, and froze to death in those harsh moments of reality between matches. Because even though matches can burn, they're light, not heat. My breath caught against that solid, expanding weight and couldn't get past it. I couldn't breathe in, couldn't breathe out, just this knot of stale air choking me. Leaves and branches rattled in the distance as I fell to my knees, gasping for breaths that wouldn't come. I curled my hand into a fist and pounded it into my chest, but aside from a second throbbing pain, nothing changed. Why couldn't I breathe? A hand touched my shoulder and I whirled around, slapping it away as I fell back from the uncoordinated movement. Desmond. I rolled onto my hands and knees, scrambled to my feet, and threw the waterfall into the cave, but he followed me, catching me when I tripped on a dip in the floor and fell again. He lowered me gently to the ground and knelt in front of me. He studied my face as I struggled for air.
"I know you don't have any reason to trust me, but do it anyway, just for a minute."
His hand came toward my face and I slapped it away again. Shaking his head, he spun me quickly and pinned my arms to my side with one arm, and his other hand covered my nose and mouth.
"Breathe in," he whispered against my ear. "Doesn't matter if it's a full breath. You'll still get some air. Breathe in."
I tried, and maybe he was right, maybe there was some, but I couldn't feel it. All I could feel was his hand between me and what I needed to live.
"All I'm doing is forcing you to breathe in a high concentration of carbon dioxide," he continued calmly. "Breathe in. The carbon dioxide attaches to your bloodstream in place of oxygen and slows your body's responses. Breathe in. When your body gets to a critical point, when you're on the verge of passing out, your body's natural responses push past the psychological factors. Breathe in."
Each time he gave me the instruction, I tried to obey. I truly did, but there just wasn't any air. I stopped struggling, my limbs leaden and heavy and sagged against his chest. His hand stayed sealed over my nose and mouth. With all of me so heavy, I could barely feel the weight in my chest, and slowly, as he periodically repeated his instruction, air trickled in. My head swam with sudden lightheadedness, but I was breathing. He moved his hand to my shoulder,
rubbing it up and down my arm as he continued to whisper, "Breathe in." Eventually it became a habit again, something I didn't have to think about, and I closed my eyes against a blinding sense of shame. I'd never had a panic attack before, though I'd seen them plenty in others, and my own inability to do anything sensible was mortifying. More so having someone else witness it. When I felt 50% sure I wouldn't fall flat on my face if I stood, I tried to push to my feet. Desmond's arms tightened around me. Not painfully, but enough that I wasn't going anywhere without a fight.
"I'm a coward," he said quietly. "Worse than that, I think I may be my father's son. But if I can help you this way, please let me."
If the little match girl had someone curled around her like this, someone warm and solid against her back, his own body wrapped around her, would she have survived? Or would they have both frozen? Shifting until his back hit the wall, Desmond gently tugged at me until I was almost sideways between his legs, my cheek pressed against his upper chest, so I could nearly hear his heartbeat. I timed my still shaky breaths to that, feeling how it jumped and skipped whenever I moved. He didn't have his brother's stocky frame, the obvious threat of muscle, nor his father's wiry strength. He was slender, like a runner, all lean angles and long planes. He hummed softly, something I didn't recognize and couldn't properly hear pressed against his chest. But his fingers brushed against my skin in the shape of piano chords. We sat in the damp, dark cave in clothing soaked from the waterfall, clinging to each other like children against a nightmare. But when I fell asleep, the nightmare would still be there. When I woke up, the nightmare would still be there. Every day for 3.5 years, the nightmare would always, always be there. And there was no comfort against that. For a few hours, though, I could pretend. I could be the little match girl and strike my illusions against the wall, lost in the warmth until the glow faded and left me back in the garden.
"They weren't just fellow captives, were they?" Victor asks after giving her a moment to collect herself. "They were your friends." "Some of them are friends. All of them are family. I guess that's just what happens."
"Sometimes it was hard to make yourself get to know other people. It would just hurt more when they died, or hurt them when you died. Sometimes it was hard to believe it was worth that pain. At the heart of the garden, though, was loneliness, and the ever-present threat of shattering, and connecting with the others seemed the safer of two evils. Not the lesser, necessarily, but the safer. So I knew that Nazira was even more worried about forgetting than Bliss. She was an artist, and she filled sketchbook after sketchbook with her family and friends. She drew outfits she'd loved, her home and school, the little swing set in the city park where she'd gotten her first kiss. She drew them over and over and panicked if the details changed or got fuzzy. There was Zara, the bitch, and when Bliss names you that, you know you're an unholy terror. Bliss was generally scathing and intolerant of bullshit. Zara's default setting was mean. I appreciated that she didn't buy into the illusion, but she made things hell for those who needed to cling to it. Like Nazira, who believed that as long as she didn't forget anything from before, she'd see it all again. Not a week went by that I didn't break up a fight between them, usually by dragging Zara to the stream and shoving her in until she cooled off. She wasn't a friend, but in quiet moments I liked her. She loved books like I did. Glennis ran and ran and ran, endless laps around the halls, until the gardener ordered Lorraine to give her twice as much food as the rest of us. Ravenna was one of the few with an MP3 player and speaker, and she'd dance for hours. Ballet, hip-hop, waltz, tap without shoes, all the classes she must have taken for years, and if you walked by her, she'd grab your arm and pull you in to dance with her. Haley loved doing everyone's hair and could make the most fantastic arrangements, and Pia wanted to know how everything worked, and Marenka did gorgeous cross-stitch. She even had a tiny pair of super-sharp embroidery scissors that the gardener required her to wear on a ribbon around her neck, so no one could use them to hurt themselves. Adara wrote stories, and Eleni painted, And sometimes Adara would ask Eleni or Nazira to illustrate scenes for her.
And there was Sirvat.
Sirvat was... Sirvat.
She was hard to know.
It wasn't just that she was standoffish, which she was, or quiet, which she was. It was that you never knew what the hell was going to come out of her mouth.
She was Lionette's final introduction.
Lionette asked me not to help with that one, because Sirvat was just that strange, and neither Lionette nor I could guess what my reaction would be. So the first time I met her was after her wings were done. She was sprawled along the stream bank, face in the mud, with Lionette staring at her in utter confusion. "What are you doing?" I asked. She didn't even look at me, half of her pale brown hair clumped with mud.
"You can die from water more ways than drowning in it. Drinking too much is as lethal as not having any."
I glanced over at the perplexed Lionette.
"Is she actually suicidal?"
"I don't think so."
She wasn't, most of the time. We learned that was just Sirvat. She identified flowers we could theoretically eat to kill ourselves, but ate none herself. She knew 1,000 different ways a person could die, and had a fascination for the girls in glass that none of us wanted to understand. She visited them almost as much as the gardener did. Sirvat was a queer duck. I honestly didn't spend much time with her, and she didn't even seem to notice, much less mind. But most of us knew each other. Even when we chose not to share our lives from before the garden, there was an intimacy to our company. For better or worse, almost always worse, we were butterflies. Irrevocable common ground.
And you mourned each other. It isn't a question. Her mouth tilts. It isn't a smile, not even a grimace, just an acknowledgement that some kind of expression should be there. Always. You never had to wait for someone to show up in the glass. You mourned them every single day, as they mourned you, because every day we were dying. Did Desmond get close to any of the other girls? Yes and no, in time. It was... She hesitates, eyes darting several times between Victor and her damaged hands, before sighing and clasping her hands in her lap, out of sight under the table. Well, you have to know it was complicated. He nods. What did his father think?
The day after Simone went into the glass, not that we saw her with the walls still down, the gardener brought me back to his suite for a fancy private dinner. So far as I could tell without specifically asking, I was the only one he brought in there. I suppose it should have been flattering, but I only found it unsettling. The conversation stayed light. He didn't mention Simone at all, and I didn't bring her up because I didn't want to know the worst of it. The only mystery this place had left was how he killed us. When dessert was finished, he told me to take a seat with a fresh glass of champagne and relax while he cleaned up. I chose the recliner rather than the couch, popping the footrest up and arranging my long skirt to cover even my feet. I could have presented at an award show in that dress, and I wondered just how much money he sank into the garden and our upkeep. He had something classical playing on an old-fashioned record player, so I closed my eyes and rested my head back against the deep padding. The thick carpeting in the suite muffled his footsteps, but I could still hear him return. He stood over me for a time, just watching. I knew he liked to watch us sleep sometimes, but it was somehow creepier when I was awake.
"Did Desmond upset you the other night?"
My eyes snapped open, which he seemed to take as his cue to perch on the arm of the chair. "Upset me?"
"I was looking over some of the footage and saw you pushing him away. He followed you into the cave, but there are no cameras in there. Did he upset or hurt you?"
"Oh. No."
"Maya?"
I managed a small smile for his sake or my own, I wasn't sure.
"I was upset, yes, but before Desmond arrived. I had a panic attack. I'd never had one before, so I didn't know what to do, and I misconstrued his arrival at first.
He helped me through it.
A panic attack?
If after a year and a half that's my strongest reaction, I don't think it's particularly alarming, do you? He returned the smile, warm and sincere.
And he helped you.